All right, so thanks for inviting me down here to give a talk. It's always fun to be here. So, is this visible? More or less. Oh, good. So I'll be talking about two papers that came out in the fall, one with Atish Dabhokar and Renata Kalash, and the other with Veronica Hubney and Mukund Rangamani. And I'll also mention bits and pieces of some work that's in progress as I go along. So I'll try to be good about references during the talk, but I should probably just, I'll preemptively make a few references at the beginning. So the two papers that really got me interested in this subject are one by Ogori Strom and Gervafa and one by Atish. A lot of the technology that for dealing with higher curvature correction to supergravity was worked out in a beautiful series of papers by Cardoso, DeWitt, Capelli, and Mohapt. Some of the results that I'll talk about at the end of the talk were independently found by Sen in a paper that came out in November, although we had a slightly different interpretation, which I can discuss at the end if you like. And there have been a few more recent papers discussing various other aspects of the higher curvature corrections to black holes, one by Su Zhang and his collaborators, and another by Giusto and Mathur. But I won't really have a chance to talk about that work. So let me just start with a rather general overview. So black holes are crucial testing grounds for a lot of our ideas about classical and quantum gravity. And in the last 10 years, a lot of the most important successes in understanding black holes have involved supersymmetric black holes. And in particular, those supersymmetric black holes, which can be constructed directly in string theory as bound states of D-brains. So for some such black holes, you can use the stringy construction to actually match the microscopic and macroscopic entropies of these black holes. So for example, you can compute a microscopic entropy, which is just the log of the number of ways of building up this black hole out of its constituent D-brains. And you can compare that to the semi-classical entropy predicted by Bekenstein and Hawking, which is just 1/4 the area of the black hole in Planck units. And remarkably, as was seen by Strominger and Vaffa, these two calculations agree, including a precise numerical coefficient. And this is rightly regarded as one of the great successes of string theory. But today, I'd like to focus on another class of black holes that can be constructed in string theory. And for these black holes, the space-time description is considerably more puzzling. In fact, for these black holes, when you try and compute the semi-classical Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, you actually find that the area of these black holes vanishes, which means that they have no event horizon.
So why are you thinking first?
Well, okay. If you put two of them together, you can get a regular black hole, for example. They have the same charges as black holes.
Lots of space times with the same charges.
Okay, well, how about this? Maybe at the end of the talk, if you don't think that these are black holes, they're going to become black holes, let's put it that way. And you can count, well, they're going to become black holes. That's probably the best answer. So these, of course, these black holes, or soon to become black holes, have naked singularities, which is a real disaster from the point of view of the low energy physics, because it means that there's no event horizon separating the curvature singularity from observers out at infinity. And so, as Harvey has anticipated, my claim today is that quantum corrections, and in particular those quantum corrections that we find from string theory, convert these apparently naked singularities into regular black holes with a finite area event horizon that separates the curvature singularity from asymptotic infinity. So how does this work? Well, in any quantum theory of gravity, we expect that there will be higher curvature corrections, so that in the low energy effective action, in addition to the usual Einstein-Hilbert term, we'll have also some terms that are of order curvature squared and higher. And the presence of these terms will alter the form and the structure of these low energy solutions. So in string theory, these higher curvature terms fall into two classes. First of all, there are classical world sheet effects, which are controlled by dimensionful parameter alpha prime that sets the characteristic size of a string. And then there are the genuine quantum effects, which arise from higher loop contributions. And these are controlled by dimensionless parameter G string. So today, for most of my talk, I'll discuss black holes where the string scale is smaller than all other scales in the problem, so that only G string effects are important. And to refine the claim that I made on the previous transparency, it's the tree and one loop G string terms, which in the language of these curvature corrections are the order curvature and order curvature squared terms, which are sufficient, at least in many cases, to clothe our naked singularities. So the plan today will be the following. So first, I'll just describe the basic setup, which is type 2 Ayano-Calabi-Yau. In particular, I'll tell you how to incorporate these higher curvature terms in a manifestly supersymmetric way into the low energy action. And then I'll discuss the effect of these higher curvature terms on the black hole solutions. I'll go on to present the main results of the talk, which is that the quantum effects can create a horizon for a naked singularity. And I'll describe the perturbation expansion in some detail, just to make it clear that we can really trust these effects, even though they do arise from higher loop contributions. And then at the end, last part of my talk, I'll talk about some special fun features of these black holes. I'll show you that quantum corrections actually make the relationship between the entropy and area changed from the usual Bekenstein-Hawking relation. And I'll also describe the full metric of these black holes before concluding at the end. So let me also encourage everyone to ask questions and let me know if I'm going too slow or too fast or anything like that. So the theory I'll be considering today is type 2A compactified from 10 down to 4 dimensions on a Calabi-Yau. This compactification is designed to preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So the low energy theory is an n equals 2 supergravity theory. And there are a variety of multiplets of this theory. The two that I'll be interested in today are the gravity multiplet, which contains a graviton, a gravitino, and a gauge boson called the gravifoton. And there are also vector multiplets. These are multiplets which contain a complex scalar, a fermion, and a gauge boson. And in general, there'll be many of them, so I've labeled them by an index A. And here, A runs from 1 up to N, where the number of vector multiplets is fixed just by the topology of the Calabi-Yau, and it's some Betti number which roughly counts the number of 4 cycles in the Calabi-Yau. So just to make things simpler, I'll be working in a notation where the gravifoton and the gauge boson are combined into a single n plus 1 component vector, A mu I, where I now runs from 0 up to n. And associated to that n plus 1 component gauge boson, I'll consider n plus 1 scalar fields, where I now runs from 0 up to n. And these will just be the projective coordinates that parameterize this vector multiplet moduli space. So of course, as everyone here probably knows, these scalars xi parameterize a set of deformations of the internal Calabi-Yau. And in particular, because they're vector multiplet scalars, they parameterize the Kähler deformations, which measure the sizes of the various internal cycles on the Calabi-Yau. And so because I'm using projective coordinates, the quantity which measures the size of some 4 cycle in the Calabi-Yau will be a ratio like xA over x0, where A labels one of the 4 cycles. So how do we write down supersymmetric actions? Well, to write down an action, all we need to do is specify some function f that depends on the moduli fields, called the prepotential. And then an action is just written down by promoting these moduli to vector superfields, and then integrating the prepotential over half of superspace. And then the functional form of the prepotential F will completely summarize all the possible terms that you can have involving vector multiplets consistent with supersymmetry. So if you wanted to, you could go ahead and expand out this superspace action into a regular bosonic action. You'd find some nonlinear sigma model for the moduli fields xi. You'd find some kinetic and interaction terms for the vector fields. I won't write those down for you, but just to say that the form of all these various couplings is completely fixed by this function f. So, as I mentioned, we'll be interested in higher curvature corrections, which means that we need to couple these vectors to gravity. And, of course, to do that, we need to define some chiral field. So I'll just define a chiral field W, which contains all the various field strengths of the gravity multiplet. Its lowest component is the graviphoton field strength. Its highest component is the Riemann curvature. And the various intermediate components are some horrible fermion terms that I won't write down. And then to write down a supersymmetric action coupling the vectors to gravity, all we need to do is promote this prepotential to be a function both of the moduli fields xi and the square of this chiral field. Are there any questions on that? So this describes the most general action involving couplings between the vector multiplets and gravity that I can write down consistent with the n equals 2 supersymmetry. So just to get a feeling for what these sorts of prepotentials look like, let's imagine expanding this prepotential that's a function both of the moduli and W squared in powers of this chiral field W. So I've called the different terms in this expansion FG, where G runs from 0 up to infinity. And it's a fact that is pretty easy to show that this term FG is a genus G contribution, which is to say it arises at the G loop level in the string perturbation expansion. So for example, the F0 term, which involves no powers of the chiral field W, is just the usual prepotential involving couplings of the various vector fields to each other. And that's found by doing some string tree level computation. The F1 term, which involves W squared, so leads to order curvature squared terms in the action, is found by doing some string one loop contribution, and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to go through any of the computations of what these prepotential terms are for type 2 ionic Calabi-Yau, but let me just write down the answer for you so that you can see what they look like. So the first thing to note is that they depend only on the topology of the Calabi-Yau. So for example, this F0 term is given by contracting the four-cycle intersection numbers with some moduli fields. So remember that if I have some four cycles in a six-dimensional Calabi-Yau, I can intersect three four cycles to get a point, which means that I can write down some topological numbers, which are just the four-cycle intersection numbers, and I can contract them with three moduli fields, and that gives me the tree-level prepotential. And similarly, the one-loop prepotential, which tells me what the curvature squared terms are in the action, also only depends on the topology of the Calabi-Yau. And it's determined by the coefficients of the second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau contracted with the various moduli fields. So I should point out here that the prepotential terms I've written down here are the terms that are tree level in one loop in G string, but are purely tree level in alpha prime. So there are various corrections to these terms coming from one loop and world sheet instanton effects that are higher powers in alpha prime that I've neglected. And in order to neglect these, I need to demand that the sizes of all the internal cycles in my Calabi-Yau are large in string units, which means that this some particular ratios of the moduli fields need to be much bigger than one. Of course, I could try and play the same game with these higher world sheet effects, and I've played around with that a little bit, but I think you can see all of the physics just at the level of these tree-level world sheet effects. And so it's really, really not necessary to get at the fundamental physics. Are there any questions before I consider?
Yeah.
before I continue? Good. So what do black hole solutions look like in this theory? Well, today I'll be interested in static spherically symmetric black holes, which preserve half of the supersymmetry, so they're n equals 1. And these are just the supersymmetric versions of extremal Reisner-Nordström. So remember, I have n plus 1 gauge fields in the game. So these black hole solutions will be parameterized by n plus 1 electric and magnetic charges, which are given by integrating either the field strengths or their magnetic duals over some two-sphere out at infinity.
Can I ask that?
Sure.
Are those solutions with the order r squared term in the gravity action?
I'll tell you about some solutions just without the r squared, and then I'll tell you what happens when you include the r squared terms. So that's sort of where I'm going with this. But you can certainly, all the formalism I'll present here is, you could include all the higher curvature corrections you like.
And have the metrics known for the analog?
Absolutely. I'm going to get there. So that's one of the main goals of my talk today, is to tell you about some of these metrics. No, good. That's the right question, though. So we have these n plus 1 electric and magnetic charges. Now, remember that I'm working in a formalism where the graviphoton is all mixed up with the other n gauge bosons that come from the vector multiplets. That means there's a special linear combination of these electric and magnetic charges, which is the charge measured by the graviphoton field strength. And I've written down this graviton charge for you here. It's, as I said, a linear combination of the magnetic and electric charges. And the various coefficients in this linear relation are the moduli fields and Fi, which are the partial derivatives of the prepotential. The actual form isn't so important, but just to remember that the terms in this linear relation depend on where I'm sitting in moduli space, because they involve Xi and Fi. So why is this particular linear combination of the charges interesting? Well, remember that the graviphoton appears in the same multiplet as the graviton, which means that the graviphoton gauges a central U1 symmetry of the theory. And so this graviphoton charge Z is the central charge appearing in the supersymmetry algebra. And in particular, any relation that you would derive from the supersymmetry algebra, like a BPS bound, will involve this particular linear combination of the charges.
Just for this formula, so the Xi, wasn't that a field?
The Xi is a field,
And the Z is just a number, so in this
That's right. So it'll need to be a... That's right. I'm precisely getting to that question. Good. Again, you're asking the right question. So I'll end up evaluating it at the horizon of the black hole. So what do these black holes look like? Well, they're asymptotically flat, and they have event horizons most of the time. So remember that these are basically generalizations of Reisner-Nordström. And the Reisner-Nordström black hole has an area that goes like Q squared. So it probably won't surprise you that the area also goes like the charge squared. And in particular, it goes like the square of the central charge Z. And they have a lot of other nice properties. They're near horizon ADS2 times S2. But those properties aren't so important for what I'm trying to get at today. So at this point, I've told you everything you need to know to find the area and the entropy of these black holes. You just need to calculate this central charge. But if you think about this for a second, you immediately encounter a bit of a puzzle, which is that these fields Xi are just essentially massless scalar fields. So I could set their vacuum expectation values out at infinity to be whatever I like. And we wouldn't expect the detailed properties of this black hole, such as its area or entropy, to depend on the asymptotic values of the moduli, which I could fix out at infinity. Or to state that puzzle a little more sharply, we wouldn't expect the entropy of the black hole, which is a discrete quantity, to depend on continuous parameters like the values of the moduli. We would only expect it to depend on discrete quantities like the charges of the black hole, which are quantized. So the resolution to this puzzle is known as the attractor mechanism, which is a beautiful story that was worked out by Ferrara, Kalash, and Strominger. And the basic observation is that because the moduli fields Xi live in vector multiplets, they couple to the charges of the black hole in a particular way. And in particular, there'll be functions of the radius that run to values at the horizon, which are independent of whatever the asymptotic values out at infinity were. And in fact, the values at the horizon are determined only by the charges, so that no matter where you start in moduli space, by the time you get to the horizon of the black hole, you end up at a point, and the position of that point is determined only by the charges. And so I've written down here the equation that determines where that point is on moduli space. Its actual form isn't so important, but just to notice that here I have 2n plus 2 equations which fix the moduli xi and their n plus 1 complex moduli, so that this completely fixes the values of the moduli only in terms of the charges. Any questions? Did that answer your, I think that answered your question. Great, so now I've told you everything you need to know. So let's see what some of these results look like. Well, yes?
But still, I can still get whatever I want at infinity.
Absolutely.
So
but the
I have some infinite family of solutions.
That's right. You could think of it as you could put a black hole in a bath of whatever background you like. And the values of that background are just set by whatever point on moduli space I want to sit at infinity. But the properties of the black hole don't depend on how hot the bath is that it's sitting in or something like that. That's a bad analogy. But you know what I mean. Good. All right, so let's see what some of these black holes look like. So I wrote down for you the tree level prepotential here, which depended on these intersection numbers, DABC. So we could go ahead and do this calculation that I've outlined for you and calculate the area of this black hole. And the answer you find is something that's quadratic in the charges. In particular, it goes like the square root of 3 magnetic charges times an electric charge, with some coefficients that depend on these triple intersection numbers. So for some black holes, such as those which have 4 or more non-vanishing charges, this area will be finite. And that means that these black holes will have finite regular event horizons. But when some of the charges vanish, in particular, when this particular combination of the charges vanish, then the black hole seems to have no horizon, at least at tree level. And so we would say it has a naked singularity. So let's look at what happens once I include one-loop effects. In particular, I'll look at the black holes which at tree level have vanishing area, but then I'll take into account this one-loop contribution to the prepotential, which, remember, depended on these Chern class coefficients, dA. And what you find is that even though at tree level the area vanished, at loop level the area is non-vanishing. And in particular, you find something that's linear in the charges and looks like the square root of the product of a magnetic and an electric charge. Yes?
And just after a question about philosophy, so how can you compare a black hole in two different theories, I mean, in two different Lagrangians?
No, it's the same Lagrangian, just different charges. You fix the Calabi-Yau you're on, and then you ask, what kind of objects can I have in this theory? So I can change the charges, which in the string theory description just corresponds to wrapping brains around different cycles in the Calabi-Yau, or adding momentum or something like that. So I'm just considering the spectrum of objects that's allowed in a given theory. Then you could also ask about playing with the Calabi-Yau, but that's sort of that's a higher order question. Any other? Well, maybe. Okay, I'll probably answer a lot of your questions on this in the next transparency. So maybe, or do you have a really? So the string coupling appears. So because we're working in an n equals 2 theory, and the string coupling appears in a hypermultiplet. It'll become a little more clear on the next transparency exactly where that fits in. So what we've seen is that you find a black hole which at tree level appears to have zero area. But then once we include the one loop term, it has non-zero area. So when can we trust this result? So first of all, in order to even talk about a metric, we need all the curvature scales to be far below the Planck scale, which means that this area needs to be large. And so that means that I need to take the charges of this black hole to be large in order that this be a big number. And there's nothing too surprising about this. Whenever we want to talk about comparisons between string theory and macroscopic black holes, we always need to do it for black holes with large values of the charge. So for example, it's only in this regime that you can get the matching between the microscopic and macroscopic entropies of Strominger and Vafa. Also, I told you earlier that I was neglecting some alpha prime corrections to the prepotential, which means that I need to demand that the volumes of the various cycles be large in string units. And that tells me that I need some ratio of the charges, which sets the volume of that cycle to be much bigger than one. And that's just a technical assumption in order that the expansion that we're using is valid. And I should make one more comment that might be bothering about something that might be bothering you, which is that because we needed to go to a one loop term in the perturbation expansion, one might worry that what we're actually doing here is balancing terms in a perturbation series against each other so that we would have no right to neglect higher order terms. But in fact, I'd like to emphasize that this is not the case, and that what we're really doing is a well-defined perturbation expansion in powers of 1 over q, which for the black holes we're looking at is much smaller than 1. In particular, you saw that the tree level term that I wrote down a couple slides ago scaled like q squared, and it had some coefficient that depended on the triple intersection numbers. And so what we're looking at is a class of black holes where that leading term vanishes, so that we now need to go to next order in 1 over q in order to get a non-zero answer. And as you saw on the previous slide, the next term scales like a power of q. And so in general, we'll be far subleading compared to this leading term. And it's only in cases where the tree level term vanishes that we ever care about this subleading term. And of course, if I wanted to, I could consider even higher curvature contributions, but these will be further subleading in powers of q. For example, the r to the fourth terms will scale like q to the zero, r to the sixth like 1 over q, and so on and so forth. So did I answer your question? I don't know if I actually answered your question.
Well, I guess so.
So the point is, so the point is this is the area in Planck units. And so essentially, I factored out all of my g-strings out of everything. So this is just a number. It's A over L Planck, which is only a function of the charges. But if I wanted to, I could go and put all my g-strings back in there. But, well, yeah.
But if it scales out to the leading term, it wouldn't scale out to the second term.
No, this is just a number. Once I scale, so the air, so the point is that in n equals 2 theories, the couplings between the hyper and vector multiplets are highly constrained. And g-string lives in a hypermultiplet. And so it can only appear coupled to vector, it can only appear in this formula in, you know, along with certain powers of alpha prime such that it looks like M Planck. And in particular, it turns out that because of this constraint between the hypermultiplet and the vector multiplets, that the g-string expansion is precisely equivalent to the 1 over q expansion for these black holes. And that wouldn't be true in general, but it's because it's true that we can actually write down a well-defined perturbation expansion. I mean, in general, just on the grounds of dimensional analysis, you might expect that r squared terms would only be relevant when the curvatures are Planck scale. But the point is that there's another dimensionless parameter in the game, which is the charge of the black hole. And the terms that appear in our low energy effective action are not just suppressed by powers of M Planck, but also have some additional factors of the charge that come in such a way that this is a well-defined perturbation series. So I think that. So are there any other questions?
Are these black holes mechanically stable?
They're supersymmetric.
So that protects them from
any
dynamics?
Well, it protects them from a lot of dynamics.
There are some cases where these things kind of separate?
So, okay, so there are these split attractor flows. So there's split attractor flows, but yeah. So there are these split attractor flows, but that's, as far as I know, a different class of solutions than the ones that we're considering. In particular, it was only as you approached funny regions and moduli space that you had to take into account the split attractor flow business. Sorry, did I answer your question?
Well, sort of. I'm now wondering how, if they don't have any dynamics, how do you form them?
Well, this is the usual question about BPS black holes, which is that they're difficult to make because... Well, so, I mean, it's, so, you know, you could, we could argue about this for a while if you like. So for example, you could imagine a normal charged black hole that radiates away all of its extra matter and so eventually reduces itself to an extremal black hole. But I think if you actually ask about that process, it would take an infinite amount of time. So you could consider these black, so the way that I like to think about it is that these black holes are just a special case of the more general black holes where I can actually do all the calculations because of all the, you know, all of the special properties of supersymmetry. But yeah. But of course, they're quite special black holes. That, yeah, right.
It doesn't really take an infinite amount of time because when you get the clock,
this
is the genuine ground state for these charges.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't it be reached in a finite time? Right.
Okay, I guess that's right. I mean, I think.
But after the finite number of states, we'll get to what's called the continuous ground state in a finite time.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that's right.
The time
of C to the S. Quit.
That might be sure.
Didn't
say I said finite.
Yes,
finite.
Okay, I guess you're right.
Yeah. So that's a naive question.
I guess in the classical approximation, it takes an infinite amount of time. But the point is that, okay.
Is there some special geometrical symmetry that's assumed for these black holes, like spherical or something like that?
Absolutely. I'm assuming spherical symmetry.
So is the connection, for example, for these flows, if the exterior, if the perturbations are not spherically symmetric, you know, this business might be what you call it, where you get start from your values and your fields, and it flows into one particular value of the charges on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Is that hold true in the non-spherical symmetric case? Because it isn't true for ordinary classical black holes that if you have a for example, a perturbation on the outside,
right,
that will change the area.
Okay. Well, yeah. So as I said, these are supersymmetric black holes, which means that there's some sort of positive energy theorem in this background, which means that we're actually in the genuine ground state and we won't decay any, you know, the genuine ground state subject to whatever asymptotic charges we put on the configuration out at infinity. So, yeah. But you can actually write down the attractor equations and all that stuff, even without spherical symmetry. I think there's no obstruction to that. Yeah. What's that? Well, I didn't say that I'd written them down. I think Cardoso, DeWitt, Capelli, and Mohabt had a paper where they wrote.
No, that's it's not the asymmetric ones. The stationary ansatz.
Yeah, they wrote down stationary ansatz. Yeah. So it's station.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. I see what you mean. It's still spherically symmetric, of course, but just stationary. But they did consider. Well, they do have these equations for multi-black hole solutions.
Okay, multi-center. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's, well, at least when you're talking about these split attractor flows and things like that, that would be the, well, that's that would be the relevant equation. But anyway. Are there any other questions? Great. So let's see. Maybe I could just spend a few minutes talking about a specific example, which will hopefully clarify a few of these issues. So let me talk about the example of type 2a on K3 times T2. So in this case, the prepotential is very simple. And in fact, one can show that the prepotential is actually one loop exact. So that the terms that I wrote down, F0 and F1, are all of the terms that would arise in perturbation theory. And this is a symptom of the fact that the low energy theory actually preserves n equals 4 rather than n equals 2 supersymmetry. And in fact, it's dual to heterotic string theory on T6. And so in this case, the sorts of black holes that I've been talking about have a very simple interpretation in the heterotic picture. In particular, the two-charge black holes, which at tree level have zero area, simply look like fundamental heterotic strings. And the two charges, Q0 and P1, are just the number of units of winding and momentum of these fundamental strings around some internal cycles. And so these objects were studied by Sen about a decade ago. And what he showed is that, in fact, you can just count the entropy by studying the states of this fundamental string that's wrapping around some internal cycle. And you can do this using some simple combinatorics, and you get an entropy that scales linearly in the charges and looks like the product of the magnetic and electric charge. And this led Sen to conjecture that even though the area looks like it vanishes at tree level, the fact that the entropy is non-zero means that quantum effects should generate a stretched horizon with some area that also scales linearly with the charges. And so if you look at the expression for the one-loop corrected area that I wrote down, then you would find that it's precisely, in this case, the product of the electric and magnetic charge. So in this case, we really should identify the horizon that we've found as the stretched horizon conjectured by Sen. However, in this particular case, because of the enhanced n equals 4 supersymmetry, there's a subtlety that doesn't arise for the generic Calabi-Yau. So the basic problem is that when we have n equals 4 supersymmetry, we're no longer allowed to set G string to be whatever we like. And the reason is that usually in n equals 2 theories, the hypermultiplets and vector multiplets don't talk to each other. But here, because I'm considering a half BPS solution of n equals 4 theory, where the n equals 2 hypers and n equals 2 vectors get knit together into a single n equals 4 vector, that means that the quantities that usually in n equals 2 backgrounds don't get fixed because they live in hypermultiplets actually will get fixed by the charges. And in particular, you can go through the calculation and you see that G string for these black holes actually is fixed at the horizon by the charges. And in particular, G string gets very small at the horizon so that the strings are weakly coupled near the horizon. And the coupling constant just goes like 1 over the product of the two charges to the 1/4 power. So if we then go back and look at the area that I wrote down, so I wrote down the area for you in Planck units, which looked like the square root of the product of these two charges, and we could take it to be very large. But if you actually evaluate the area in string units, we need to put in some factors of this G string, which is getting very small. And what you find is that even though the area in Planck units is large, the area in string units is not large. And in fact, it's order 1. And so in retrospect, this shouldn't have surprised us, because for this very special class of black holes, our black hole is just an excited string. So it's not so surprising that its characteristic size is string scale. And this is sort of reminiscent of the stringy correspondence principle outlined by Gary and Joe. So I should emphasize that in the generic case, where we only have n equals 2 rather than n equals 4 supersymmetry, the coupling G string is not fixed by the charges. So we could take the area to be large in both string and Planck units, and we wouldn't have to worry about this particular set of subtleties. Are there any questions on that? So having told you about the basic results, let me now just tell you about a few bizarre features of these black holes. So one of the most intriguing features involves quantum corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking relation between area and entropy. So it's been known for a long time that higher curvature, R squared, or higher terms will alter the usual relation between entropy and area. So there are a variety of ways to see this, and I'll describe for you one that was really pioneered by Wald. So the basic idea is to use the first law of thermodynamics. dE is TdS plus, for rotating black holes, omega dJ. And then the basic observation is that the energy and the angular momentum, E and J, are just some charges, which can be defined by integrating on some sphere out at infinity. And these can be defined even in the presence of higher curvature terms. And this allows one to identify an entropy. And the expression is so simple that I really couldn't resist the temptation to write it down. All you have to do is take the action and differentiate it with respect to the curvature. For some arbitrary action involving high powers of the curvature, and then just integrate that over the horizon to get the entropy. So what does this higher derivative corrected version of the entropy look like? Well, from the usual Einstein-Hilbert term in the action, that just gives you the usual Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, 1/4 of the area. And then the various higher curvature terms will give you some corrections to this, which for most black holes are very small compared to this leading term. But let's see what happens for our black holes. So at tree level, which is to say neglecting all of the various higher curvature terms, I already showed you that the area is zero, and of course the entropy will be zero also. But at loop level, I've argued for you that the area is non-zero, and one can go ahead and calculate the entropy of these black holes. And you find that the entropy is, well, it has two contributions. There's the 1/4 of the area that comes from the usual Bekenstein-Hawking term now applied to this one loop corrected area. But then there are the corrections coming from the R-squared terms, which also turn out to be 1/4 of the area. So that the total entropy of the black hole is now 1/2 the area instead of 1/4 of the area. So I don't want you to take that factor of 1/2 all that seriously. Well, you can take it seriously, but it's not, how can I put this? So it's possible, as I'll show in the next transparency, to get other values for the coefficient there instead of 1/2. But I think the general moral that you should take away from this story is that for these black holes, where quantum corrections to the area are large, quantum corrections to the area entropy relation will be large as well. So let me mention one caveat, which is that this derivation of the entropy is really only valid when the temperature is non-zero. And that's because it relied on the first law of thermodynamics. And so to write down an entropy, we had to divide both sides of the first law of thermodynamics by a factor of the temperature. So for supersymmetric black holes, where the temperature vanishes, we should really regard this expression for the entropy as just a conjecture. But because it's a conjecture that reproduces all of the microscopic entropies that we can calculate in string theory, such as Senn's entropy for the K3 times T2 black hole, I would say that it's an extremely well-motivated conjecture. So let me just mention a few open questions regarding this modified area entropy relation. So I think one really interesting possibility is that we can understand this factor of 1/2 in perturbative string theory. So the basic observation is that if I try and scatter some massless scalar field off of a black hole, then for a very general class of black holes, in the long wavelength limit, that scattering cross-section is precisely equal to the area of the horizon. And so even though it makes no sense to calculate an area in perturbative string theory, one could still imagine calculating this cross-section in perturbative string theory. And so then you could imagine calculating both the entropy and the cross-section of this black hole using the D-brain description of black holes, and then either verify or disprove this relation S equals 1/2 A, or in this case, 1/2 sigma. And I should emphasize that this isn't a completely hopeless task, because Das and Mathur were able to show for the usual class of Straumann-Dravatha black holes that you can reproduce precisely the factor of 1/4 that appears in Bekenstein and the Bekenstein and Hawking relation using a perturbative string theory calculation. Any questions on that? One other interesting question is to ask what other relations between the area and the entropy one can find. So it turns out, although I won't go through the details for you, that one can find other black holes where the entropy is proportional to area, but with a different constant of proportionality. And it turns out that this constant of proportionality is a function of the charges. And in particular, it's a function that can never be made too large. And so I have no explanation for this fact, but it's simply a phenomenological observation. And the basic reason why it can't be made so large is that this function C, in order to get it to go to infinity, I need to take one of the charges to be very small. But charge quantization constrains how small I can take the charges. So for example, in our favorite example of K3 times T2 black holes, I can get this constant to be a quarter. That's just the usual case. I can get it to be a half, which is the case I showed for you earlier. I can get it to be 3/4, but I can't get it to be any higher.
You can't get it to be log 3 over 8 pi?
I can't.
But you know why I'm asking.
I know why you're asking.
But that's the spoiler of a quarter.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I don't think I can get it smaller. Anyway. No, but I can get it to be log of 128 or whatever. What is the
that would be cool.
The equivalent in 10 dimensions, right? So
this must be string input, right? Just from GR point of view.
That's right. So you need to put in the fact that charges are quantized. That's the only
I think it's more than that. The information about the clavier.
Oh, sure, sure. So this depends. So the two inputs I need to put in are, first of all, I need to know what the triple intersection numbers are. I need to know what the Chern class coefficients are. And then I need to know in what units the charges are quantized. And then once I do that, then you can just write down this relation. Although I should emphasize that I don't have a proof of this for the most general black holes. This is just sort of an observation. Okay, so, Greg, that's a good question. So the answer is yes. That C, that factor of a quarter is precisely the thing that gives you the 1/4, I thought you were asking about the viscosity bounds, but that's just because you work on viscosity bounds, and I just totally imagined that you asked that question. You asked about covariant entropy bounds? Well, I mean, you could imagine that this is a violation of the usual entropy bound. And the reason is that we've put in some higher curvature terms, so we're just no longer working in Einstein gravity, so that there's no reason to believe these covariant entropy bounds.
Is there a general result on the sign?
I think in all the examples I can remember, you always increase the entropy, but that
include the quantum directions to black holes which don't have zero area as well?
I believe it does. So in the examples that I know of, so people have calculated the one loop corrections to the Strauman-Dravaffa black holes, which have non-vanishing area at tree level. And you always add some 1/12 times there's some extra little bit there, but it always increases. And so that's actually.
So is there a simple physical reason why quantum correction should really increase?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry? Oh, okay, sorry. So the basic point is that the coefficient that appears here is precisely the coefficient that appears in the viscosity bound. And the reason is that if you define the shear viscosity on some gauge theory out at infinity, out in an asymptotic region, then you can relate that shear viscosity to a scattering cross-section for a scalar field. And as I mentioned above, the scattering cross-section for a scalar field is precisely the area of a black hole. So if I'm looking at some thermal gauge theory and I want to write down the ratio of the viscosity to the entropy, then that's precisely just equal to that coefficient there. So
making this coefficient anything you like, you're saying you can evaluate them?
No, the point is the point is that I'm still okay. So the point is that I'm still over the 1/4 pi that you usually get, except now I'm getting 1/2 pi or something like that. So I'm actually not violating that viscosity bound. I'm going the other way.
So in this case, what is corresponding the field theory?
Oh wait. No, I am violating the bound. Sorry, because I'm dividing by entropy. Right. So this is I am violating the bound. I'm getting 1/8 pi or something like that. Okay. Anyway, sorry. What is what was your question?
So what is corresponding the field theory term of field theory?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think understanding ADS CFT for these black holes. Absolutely. So I think. Well, so I think it would be interesting. Okay. So I think it would be interesting to try and understand the gauge. So as you say, these are ADS two times S two near horizon geometries, but there's a qualitative difference between these and the usual black holes, which is that the characteristic size of the ADS now scales as the square root of the charge instead of linearly with the charge. And so this means that the number of degrees of freedom in the dual field theory scales differently than it usually does. And so I think that would be an interesting thing to try and study. And so I think Strominger, Gayato, and Yin have just written a series of papers talking about the CFT1 duals of the near horizon ADS2 geometries for the usual Strominger-Vafa black holes. And it might be interesting to see what you can do for these other classes of black holes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. All right, so maybe I can continue. So the last thing that I wanted to talk about today is the geometry of these black holes. So far I've just discussed near horizon behavior, but you can use a similar set of techniques to study the full metric. So in general, the metric takes the following form, where I've written it in terms of a time coordinate t and three flat spatial coordinates x. And all of the interesting stuff in the metric is just contained in this warp factor e to the 2g, which is a function of radius. Then the warp factor e to the 2g can then be found by solving a Killing spinner equation in this background. And at tree level, this Killing spinner equation is just some first order differential equation which can be integrated to find the form of this warp factor explicitly. So for the black holes which have non-vanishing area at tree level, so these are the ones with four or more non-vanishing charges, the geometry is very similar to the usual extremal Reisner-Nordström. We have a singularity, we have some finite area horizon which separates that singularity from asymptotic infinity. So what about the black holes we're studying today, which at tree level have zero area? Well, at tree level, the geometry has a null singularity, which means that the region that used to be the horizon has been replaced by a singularity. And although I've been calling these naked singularities, I should really have referred to them as null singularities rather than naked singularities, because the singularity lies along a light-like rather than, say, a space-like or time-like trajectory. But from a physical point of view, I should emphasize that these null singularities are just as bad as naked singularities, because an asymptotic observer out here at infinity could still see regions of arbitrarily high curvature if he or she were willing to wait long enough.
That's part of the singularity.
Oh yeah, but this is just the usual thing that whenever I write down eternal black holes, you always could imagine having stuff coming out of a singularity. So, okay. So in this sense, all eternal black holes are naked singularities. In this sense, the Schwarzschild black hole is naked singularity. And that's not the sense in which I would like to use the word naked today.
You could imagine forming.
You could imagine. Okay, right. I mean, that's the physical point, is that when you form a black hole, the question is whether you have a naked singularity if you form the black hole in some physical process, say where I throw in some stuff and I form a black hole out of it. And again, then we get to your questions about how you form BPS black holes, but, well, that's not the point of today's talk. So, okay. So because these black holes are the marginal cases that lie between naked and non-naked singularities, they're actually known in the GR literature as naked with the lights out. I didn't make that up. And in fact, I was describing them to a famous physicist who will remain nameless. And he said, oh, so you mean they're not naked, but they're still hot. So what happens when higher curvature terms are added? Well, once the curvature squared terms are added, it turns out that the differential equations which determine the warp factor become much more complicated. And the basic reason is that when we have curvature squared terms, the BPS equations now become second order instead of first order. And in general, it's impossible to find some analytic solution. Although I guess Su Zhang had a paper finding analytic solutions for some particular class of black holes. But in general, the structure of the differential equation is pretty horrible, and so it doesn't admit an analytic solution. However, if you stare at this differential equation long enough, it turns out you can still extract all of the structure that you're interested in analytically. So, for example, you can extract the causal structure. In particular, you can show that this warp factor goes to a constant out at infinity, which means the solution is asymptotically flat. The warp factor vanishes at the horizon, or it vanishes at r equals 0, and you can show that it vanishes in such a way that we have a horizon, and a horizon of precisely the area that I calculated for you earlier. And you can even show that it has a singularity at some point behind the horizon. So all of this is enough to show, even though I can't solve the equations analytically, that the null singularity has been converted into a time-like singularity hidden behind a horizon.
So how do you know the singularity behind the horizon? Is it true singularity or not just
a... You can calculate curvature. You can calculate some curvature invariant and show that it blows up. Good, yeah. So that's sort of just as we would have expected. But if you look at these solutions in more detail, you actually find something surprising, which is that although the warp factor has the general form that I wrote down for you on the last slide, it actually has these little wiggles in it, which aren't present near the horizon or out at infinity, but only arise in this intermediate region between the horizon and infinity.
What's
up, Thurston? I'll get to that. So what this means is that the warp factor, e to the 2g, is not monotonic outside the horizon. And so although this doesn't affect the causal structure of the background, which depends only on null geodesics, it has a profound effect on the physics of inertial observers, which follow time-like geodesics. And that's because for time-like geodesics, this warp factor, e to the 2g, is precisely the gravitational potential. And so the fact that it's not monotonic means that there are these little regions outside the horizon of the black hole where the gravitational force is repulsive instead of attractive. In particular, if I'm an inertial observer, I could just sit at one of these local minima at finite radius for infinite amount of time where the attractive and repulsive forces exerted by the black hole are canceled. So I should mention a few important features of this phenomenon, which is that if you look at the solution in more detail, you find out that the period of the fluctuations is set by a ratio of the charges. In particular, it's set by precisely the ratio of the charges that I showed you earlier determines the volume of some internal cycle in the Calabi-Yau. So what that means is that the characteristic period of these fluctuations is precisely the compactification scale for some cycle of the internal Calabi-Yau. So in particular, for a very large observer, one who's too big to see the internal compactification manifold, then this observer should average over many of these little wiggles, and we'll see an effective potential that's monotonic and purely attractive. It's only a very small observer, one whose size is of order the compactification scale, who could see these non-monotonicities. Does that, I think that, yeah. So the other thing I should mention is that usually in GR, we're not used to seeing repulsive gravitational forces like this. And that's because we couple gravity to matter which obeys some positive energy condition. And the reason why these repulsive gravitational forces are allowed is that the higher curvature terms that I've written down violate a positive energy condition. And in particular, you can see that they violate what's called the null energy condition. And you can just see this by calculating the various components of the Ricci curvature. And I should point out that it's actually quite common for quantum corrections to violate energy conditions like the null energy condition. And in fact, if you think of everyone's favorite example of quantum effects in a curved background, namely Hawking radiation, then you can evaluate the stress tensor of Hawking radiation. And what you see is that outside the black hole horizon, it just looks like some negative energy falling into the black hole, which makes the black hole want to shrink. And so that's telling you that Hawking radiation also is violating a local positive energy condition. But there, I should point out that there is a global energy condition, which is not violated either for Hawking radiation or for the higher curvature terms that we're including here. And that's something called the average null energy condition, where I take this particular component of the Ricci curvature and I integrate it over an affine parameter. So physically, what that's telling you is that even though locally there are regions where it looks like I have some negative energy density, there are regions right next to those regions where we have some positive energy density. And that's enough positive energy to cancel the negative energy density so that overall it looks like we have some positive energy. And it's only locally where it gets split up into positive and negative energy bits. Are there any questions about that? All right, so I see that I'm out of town, that was a good one, yeah, okay. I see that I'm out of time, so that was fine. Okay, well, maybe I can just make one aside before I finish, which is that now that we're violating a positive energy theorem, all other kinds of wonderful things might be allowed. Black hole evaporation, violating holographic bounds, which we've already seen, because we violated the usual Bekenstein-Hawking bound, or a violation of singularity theorems, either of cosmology or of black hole formation. But I'll leave that for another day. So let me just present a few conclusions. So this is the first example where higher curvature corrections found from string theory convert an apparently pathological solution of gravity into a regular black hole with a finite horizon. And this has been done in a well-defined perturbative calculation where further curvature corrections can be neglected. In particular, the area can be made arbitrarily large in Planck units, and it still makes sense to talk about a metric because all the curvature scales are very small. Nevertheless, we saw for these backgrounds, certain quantum corrections are still very important. For example, the corrections to the area entropy relation are large, and violations of the positive energy condition lead to repulsive gravitational forces. So maybe I'll stop there.